everyone wants that unicorn. How about you take a zebra? Not everything has to be a unicorn, and it shouldn't be, because I have to tell you, 99% of companies are not unicorns, and they're the ones that are propping up the economy. They're the ones that are coming out with the innovations. They're still profitable. They're still making multiples. They're returning to their investors. They're improving patients' lives, and they're improving, you know, the physicians' lives and their day-to-day and, you know, their workflow.
Welcome to MedCider, where you can learn from the brightest founders and CEOs in medical devices and health technology. Join tens of thousands of ambitious doers as we unpack the insights, tactics, and secrets behind the most successful life science startups in the world. Now, here's your host, Scott Nelson.
Hey everyone, it's Scott. In this episode of MedCider, I sat down with Marissa Fayer, CEO of DeepLook Medical. Marissa has over two decades of experience as a medtech executive, entrepreneur, investor, and philanthropist, spanning companies like Hologic and Olympus. She's the founder of the Her Health EQ, a nonprofit focused on advancing global women's health, and an entrepreneur in residence at Graybella Capital and Goddess Gaia Ventures. Here are a few of the key things that we discussed in this conversation. First, make sure that you're solving a real problem rather than creating solutions in search of a gap. Identify a genuine need and develop a product that enhances efficiency and outcomes while fitting seamlessly into existing workflows. Second, when engaging with FDA, explain your technology in layman's terms. Leverage predicates if they're available. Design trials primarily for regulatory purposes, but ensure they're equitable for broader credibility. And third, accelerators are valuable for startups at any stage. They can offer networks, new perspectives, publicity, and even potential funding opportunities. However, they are also time-consuming, so assess the benefits and choose wisely. All right, before we jump into this episode, I wanted to let you know that the latest edition of MedCider Mentors is now live. We just published Volume 5, which summarizes the key learnings from the most popular MedCider interviews over the last several months with incredible entrepreneurs like Gabriel Jones, CEO of Proprio, Kirsten Carroll, CEO of Can Do Health, Dr. David Albert, founder of AliveCor, Greg Bullington, CEO of Magnolia Medical, and other leaders of some of the hottest startups in our space. Look, it's tough to listen or read every interview that comes out, even the best ones, but there are so many valuable lessons you can pick up from the founders and CEOs that join our program. So that's why we decided to create MedCider Mentors. It's the easiest way for you to learn from the world's best medical device and health technology entrepreneurs in one central place. To check out the latest volume, head over to MedCiderRadio.com/mentors. Premium members get free access to all past and future volumes. If you're not a premium member yet, you should definitely consider signing up. In addition to every volume of MedCider Mentors, you'll get full access to the entire library of interviews dating back to 2010. You'll also be able to see all of our playbooks, which are handpicked collections of the most insightful interviews with the brightest founders and CEOs that join our program. Whether you're looking to master capital fundraising, navigate early stage development, tackle regulatory challenges, understand reimbursement, or position your venture for a meaningful exit, MedCider playbooks have you covered. And last, considering that fundraising can be one of the most daunting tasks for any startup, we created a meticulous database of investors right at your fingertips. Explore a wealth of VC funds, private equity firms, angel groups, and more, all eager to invest in medical device and health technology startups. Access to this database is a premium member exclusive, so don't miss out. Learn more about MedCider Mentors and our premium memberships by visiting MedCiderRadio.com/mentors. All right, without further ado, let's jump into the interview. All right, Marissa, welcome to MedCider. Appreciate you coming on.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, I am looking forward to this conversation, learning a little bit more about DeepLook. But before we get there, let's spend maybe, you know, 5-10 minutes talking a little bit more high level. So before stepping into the CEO role, give us a sense kind of for your background, maybe an elevator style pitch leading up to your current role.
Yeah, for sure. So medtech exec, got into engineering. Well, I was an engineer, so got recruited out of school, went straight into healthcare. I thought I was going to aerospace. I came into healthcare and never left. So I was in corporate for about 15 years, doing new product development, manufacturing engineering work. I took on more and more roles. I was in mergers and acquisitions and integration, moved out of country, moved around on special products and projects. I developed a 3D mammography system, which ties into what we'll be talking about. And after 15 years, before it was popular, I think I burnt out. And before it was popular being an entrepreneur, I think that I figured out I was one. And so I started my own consulting firm when everyone said I should go into consulting. Hi, I started a firm instead, so hence the entrepreneurship. Started a global nonprofit and started advising and helping companies grow and doing a lot of, that kind of work, sitting on boards, sitting in advisory boards, and here I am today doing what I'm doing.
Yeah, no, that's great. We'll definitely link to Marissa's LinkedIn profile in the full write-up on MedSider for this particular interview. You can get a sense for sort of the colorful background, right? The number of experiences. But it's interesting that and we won't go too deep on this topic, but I recently did a presentation for a small like a med tech group, and I showed this. Are you familiar with like the midwit meme, right? Where and I was like, well, early on in my career, I was like, just got to do a lot of things, and then you get to this like the top of the bell curve where it's like, well, I need to make this move, and this if I just do this, it's going to be the perfect move, and it's like, then the ninja on the far right is like, no, just do a lot of things, right?
Yeah, just do like a lot of things and figure out what you might like to do, and you
exactly.
actually have no idea how it's all going to come together. I mean, listen, now you look back and you're like, oh, that's how it all came together, or you knit the story together. But in reality, no. When you're doing it, especially in your early career, no idea. I mean, there's a lot of smart people out there, and I think I just probably wasn't as intentional as I probably should have been.
No, I think you're dead on. That's probably the real scenario behind most people's journeys, right? Is it's like you very much figure it out as you go. But like that, not to sound cliche, but like that famous Steve Jobs quotes of like you can only connect the dots like looking backwards. I think that, I mean, the more I think upon that quote, I think it's very, very true, at least for me and probably a lot of others. It sounds like, yeah, you're the same way. So, with that said, most of your time is being spent on DeepLook. Give us a sense for like the technology, like what it is, and maybe frame that up as if I was a freshman in high school and I didn't know anything about the space. And maybe weave in like, why you're even interested in the space.
Yeah, so DeepLook has a great technology that's our flagship product. It's called DL Precise. It's based on shape recognition. It's very deterministic fixed software. So, what we were learning to code with a million years ago. And so it's the basics of AI. And we are able to measure, segment, and visualize lesions in existing images. So everyone eventually will have mammograms, ultrasounds, CT images, or MRIs. We're able to one-click measure, segment, and visualize those. It's a help for radiologists to better get to diagnosis, to better get to better information, better, decisions, and have information for them so that it helps their workflow. And so that's our first product. We have secondary products that we're working on now and that will be developed and released in the next few months. And then obviously continuing on from there, additional tools that help radiologists. For us, we're FDA cleared, which is a really big milestone for sure. And we're at the commercial stage. So we have four commercial contracts. And so it's really exciting to kind of get this technology into people's hands. And for us, we're FDA cleared across all imaging modalities and all health conditions, which is the broadest designation that you possibly could have. And so really, we help to visualize cancer or non-cancer, suspicious lesions in existing imaging. And first and foremost, we can do that in breast cancer. We're very good in dense breasts. So what we do is it's based on shape recognition and reading the technicalities of the pixels in imaging. And so that's what we do, which is exciting. And so, my background in breast cancer and in imaging, especially at Hologic, I spent 9 years out of my career, my corporate career there, developed a 3D mammography system, did a lot of work in imaging. And honestly, as a woman who has dense breasts, which affects 45% of all women in the world, disproportionately affecting Black women, Asian women, and Jewish women. Honestly, this is personal. This is personal to me and to my family and to my friends and people that, I know. And that the problem is when you have dense breast tissue or any dense tissue, you have a 2 to 3 times higher likelihood of having cancer and also having the imaging miss your cancer. And so we are a tool that can help visualize for the radiologists.
Got it. I had no idea I guess the prevalence of breast cancer was that much higher with dense tissue. I guess that's interesting. No idea. Got it. And DeepLook Medical is the website. DeepLookMedical.com is the website. Just as it sounds. We'll link to it in the full write-up on MedSider. But definitely encourage everyone if you're interested in this, if you're like your ears have been perked, right? Or you're kind of leaning into like this technology, definitely encourage everyone to check that out. So Marissa, just a couple follow-up questions. So it sounds like radiologists are primarily using the technology. So if I'm a DeepLook rep, right, am I selling into the radiology department? Like, where does this fit within that kind of the healthcare ecosystem?
Yeah, it fits into the radiology department, fits into the oncology department, fits also into clinical trials. The interesting part of our business model is that we don't have any reps for sales. We actually partner with with other distribution and channel partners because, listen, a small technology company is not going to make inroads into a hospital, but Bayer Healthcare is going to, or Tempus, which is $1 billion company, or Barco, $2 billion, owns 90% of the medical monitoring business. They have the ability to make those calls and to get in more efficiently as an additional product. And so that's how we get into radiologists' hands. Eventually, we'd love to get into patients' hands as information that their radiologist provides. So but really this is radiology, oncology, some clinical trials. That's where anybody would find us.
Got it. And you mentioned the technology is FDA cleared. I think maybe your first clearance was back in 2021, if I remember correctly. Correct. And you're actively commercializing this now.
Actively commercializing. I mean, COVID didn't help, to be clear. Nobody cared about cancer for several years. And so we're commercializing now. We have 4 commercial contracts with some very large companies. And so they've integrated our technology into their technology as additional offerings and just, additional products that they have. And so, commercializing now, which is the exciting part.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, seeing your baby kind of be born into the universe. But it's interesting that you mentioned this being used for clinical trials. That's one of the things that I, in conversations with other entrepreneurs that are kind of thinking about their, how do they go to market? How do they get through kind of the ebbs and flows of the development life cycle? And one of the things that I always encourage them is, if there's a creative way at all to demonstrate revenue early in the process, like, the better, right? It's going to be that much easier to raise capital to do your next milestone, et cetera. And I'm glad that you mentioned that, right? Because that's come up with other entrepreneurs that have been on the program. It's like they found interesting ways, and some of it's actually through trials, right? Stratos Labs is an example. I think their wearable bronchoscope, I believe, if I remember correctly. They actually, I think they had maybe some inbound interest from pharma companies or companies that wanted to use their technology for clinical trials. It was like, well, that's a perfect way to, right? Opens up some revenue, right? That helps the company, or at least positions the company in a much better light for future investment. So that's
cool. Yeah. And for us, I mean, listen, it's a different revenue stream. It's still like a software partnership and things like that, but instead of being part of just the regular screening and diagnostic pathway, it's a completely different pathway. We're relying on our partners. They're a very large company. They're enrolling people into their trials and using their software. We're a utility there. And, every time we get used, we get paid. And it's kind of, some of it's kind of passive income, but it works. Why not?
Yep. No doubt. Well, cool. Let's step inside the old MedSider time machine, as I like to call it, and kind of go back and learn a little bit more about your personal journey and really, really kind of, what you've been through at DeepLook, right? Over the past, 3 to 4 years now. And I think I'm looking at your LinkedIn profile now, you got involved with the company in 2020. Is that right?
So I joined as an advisor in 2020.
Got it.
So I was speaking in 2019, I was speaking at a conference. Two of the founders said, they came up to me after I spoke and we had a quick conversation. They're like, "You're going to be our CEO." I'm like, "We've just met. So how about I wait a little bit?" And obviously I was pre-FDA and, that was in COVID and all of these things. So I joined as an advisor for several years. And in August of 2022, I took over at the behest and blessing of the founders as CEO. And here I am. So I've been leading the company for about a year and a quarter.
Okay. Got it. And you're obviously involved. You've been taking a lot of swings, at the plate over your career, been involved in a lot of startup, kind of this entrepreneurial ecosystem. And I often think, not often think, I still fundamentally believe that like the moving through like the early stages of development, right? When you've got, not a lot of resources, very limited capital, you're trying to hit that kind of that next iteration, right? Of your product, whether it's software, whether it's hardware, et cetera. It's really, really challenging, right? Because you got to make hard decisions, you got to do things typically pretty lean. And with all of that said, what are like maybe 1 to 2 pieces of advice that you'd have for other, founders, entrepreneurs that are kind of early on in their venture, but are trying to deal with this, you know, this try to cross a lot of hurdles with not a lot of resources?
I mean, listen, it's pretty basic. Find an actual problem and like, just don't invent one. Like, find a problem that you can solve and that has either a market, an existing market, or a market that you can create and to grow. I mean, listen, you know, not everything's going to be the Uber of X, Y, and Z. Sometimes you're just something else in an existing market, or something better or something different. So like, but find problem. Don't just like create something that has actually no value to anybody and figure out how it fits. And especially in healthcare, you have to figure out how it fits into their day to day and how it fits into their workflow, their life, you know, their daily practice, because physicians and nurses and anybody in healthcare does not have any time. There's no time. And so you have to be an augment to either drastically change their outcomes or reduce the amount of time that they're spending on something. And especially this is a trend for the next 5, 10 years, but like, be a help. I only know healthcare, really. So, I mean, you know, that's what I talk about only, but I would say like, find a problem, figure it out, figure out how you can get it into the workflow. Like for us, we figure it out. We're never going to have a sales team that's going to get into a hospital. Well, how do you get your product out then? You go with channel partners. That was the better way of doing business for us personally. So, you know, I think it's just figuring out what makes the most sense and taking like just a little bit of time to think that through. Like, don't shove it down everybody's throat thinking that you know everything. Like, that's a problem. Like, you have to ask physicians, you have to ask hospital administrators, you have to ask, you know, anybody doing the work, how can you make their day better?
Right. Right. And I'm sure that that's probably the key for your particular, solution, right? At DeepLook is like really understanding, yeah, at its core, like it does this thing, right? But actually understand, like truly understanding how a radiologist, like how it fits into their workflow. Right. I think has probably been especially important. And that this topic kind of surfaces quite a bit in these conversations with other medtech founders and CEOs that I have on the program, is this idea of like, yes, you have your device, your software, whatever, is like solving this pain point, right? The solution, but really truly understanding like how it actually fits into the actual clinical workflow is huge and oftentimes underappreciated.
Yeah. Well, there's so many incredible innovations that are out there. Let's be clear. So many of them. And the problem that most of them have is that they can't figure out how to get adoption because they can't get into the workflow. You can have the best invention, the best technology. If you can't get it into people's hands because they can't, doesn't help them, or you can't get it into the system, it doesn't matter how great it is.
Right.
There's a lot there's also a lot of companies and technologies that have been acquired to be shelved because it's noise.
Yeah. You know? It's too painful.
It's too painful.
Yeah.
So you just need to like figure out how it works.
Yeah. I'm not going to name the product's name, but like there's a particular device in kind of the cardiovascular space that comes to mind that, you know, was started by a legendary entrepreneur, really, really cool, actually, technology, but I think ultimately failed because of this very thing, just too cumbersome to set up and to use. And it's just like, great idea, just never really truly fit within a normal workflow. Right. So it's like hugely important.
Yeah, and you also have to start at a certain place. You can't start at the end point. You have to start where people can understand it and where you can work, like your MVP, but make it easy. Make it something, yes, that's helpful. It's not your end product. Mm-hmm. I mean, for us, deal precise, MVP, get in the door. Our next product, that's the one everyone probably really wants. The ones after that, those are the ones that they really want. This is an incredible technology and it leverages and allows us to get to the next step, gets to the next product, gets to, you know, the next innovation. That's important. Mm-hmm. This is the first step of many. And, you know, I'm not saying we haven't figured it out, certainly, because no company actually does, but like that's what you need to do in order to get it in, get their adoption, make sure it's understandable. Don't speak in technical speak. Don't like mm-hmm. Nobody understands. Like, you're going to have to start like what we do. We start with deterministic software. It's not learning. It's not taking any images. It's not, you know, we don't have to worry about HIPAA. You don't have to worry about all these things because it's just, it's software. It's already fixed. Learn, you're like, it's done. And then you start to layer on AI and machine learning and all of these other things, you know, in the future. But like, understand where people are at right now. You might be in super deep tech, but I got to tell you, in healthcare, not there yet. So like figure out where everybody is and figure out how you can get there eventually.
Yeah, that's a good point. And so on that note, so you mentioned this idea of just getting into market, right? With like a first gen type of technology. And I'm sure you probably heard this, maybe even some from investors, maybe specifically that said, well, Marissa, I like what you're working on, but I want this game changing thing, right? That's what I really want to invest in, right? It can't be like a slightly better version. It has to be like dramatically different. What's your take on that?
Those are the dreamers, and those are, listen, there needs to be a ton of dreamers going for the moonshots, going for the big ideas, 100%. I got to tell you, one out of 100 of them are successful. When you go with actual incremental improvements, I mean, these are not real hard and fast stats. I would imagine 6 out of 10 of them are successful. That's a dramatic difference. So, I mean, yeah, everyone wants that unicorn. How about you take a zebra?
Yeah.
How about you take a gazelle? Whatever, you know, whatever analogy you want to use, you know, you could take the horse, you know, whatever you want. Not everything has to be a unicorn, and it shouldn't be, because I have to tell you, 99% of companies are not unicorns, and they're the ones that are propping up the economy. They're the ones that are coming out with the innovations. They're still profitable. They're still making multiples. They're returning to their investors. They're improving patients' lives, and they're improving, you know, the physicians' lives and their day-to-day and, you know, their workflow. Like, not everything is this pie in the sky. And yeah, of course, like, you need to see the potential, but like, you know, I don't necessarily believe in like an 100x multiple. I mean, that's just not realistic. And if all investors are looking for that, I mean, then nothing else gets invested in.
Right.
Nothing. Yeah. And we're at the status quo. So like, there needs to be a lot of people who are happy with a 5, 7, 10x, which is incredible. It's that alone is incredible. Yeah. And you add all of those up, well, then you get to 100x.
Right. And I think a lot of times that I hear this pushback around, like, you know, working on something truly differentiated, truly, you know, truly game, you know, quote unquote game changing. A lot of, like, if I add a point to a trend, it's usually coming from people that don't have like that great of commercial chops, right? Because they just don't understand. Like, you could be working on the most amazing thing, right? And it's maybe it solves a real painkiller, like a real, but it's like massively different from what someone's used to using. That's gonna equate to a ton of friction. You know what I mean?
And 20 years.
Yeah, in 20 years,
you're lucky. Exactly.
Yeah,
you know. So if you have the time and the capital to spend for those 20 years until the market actually gets to where you need it to be. Wonderful.
Yeah. It's
funny. I wish you luck.
You know? It's
like, funny. I'm happy for that. Yeah. And that's interesting to invest in for the future, but there's about 27 middle steps that have to get there for that one game changer. And by the time it actually happens, it's no longer a game changer because everything else has incremented up to that.
Yeah, no doubt. It's funny. We'll get to the next topic here in a second, but I was having the same conversation with someone recently, and we were talking about like this pitch deck, and he was like, "I'm so glad I didn't see that this thing was like incorporated AI and it's going to do all this like weird stuff that this audience that uses this product has no idea how to use." You know what I mean? And that's you know, anyway, we were kind of laughing about that, but let's shift gears a little bit. You've been involved in healthcare really throughout your entire career. I always like to kind of use the phrase that it's like, you know, if you're doing a healthcare startup, it's like playing the game on hard mode, you know, and largely because of the regulatory and clinical, you know, sort of constraints that are typically involved with most of the products that we build in the space. So with that said, like, thinking maybe frame this up just specific to DeepLook, like what has been your approach to kind of mapping out the regular, you know, that regulatory process? Because it can sometimes, you know, be overwhelming for a lot of entrepreneurs.
It is quite overwhelming. And I've had 3 conversations just today about it. So, you know, it's very time consuming and confusing. And, you know, it's really hard to understand. Thankfully, I was involved in regulatory and quality a lot when I was in corporate. So I learned a lot of that experience too. But Listen, I inherited a company more or less that had FDA clearance, which is great. The way we were able to obtain it was to make it just very like understandable, code, deterministic, not learning, because they, even years ago and increasingly today, the regulators are not that familiar with AI. While they think they might be, they're not. And it's still hard for general people to understand unless you're the tech developers. And so, it's hard. It's from us, we're taking it very like methodical, doing exactly what we should be doing, planning it out months and months in advance, making sure that the testing's there. And really, it's about showing what you're saying you're doing and proving it. And also, it's if you can use a predicate, obviously. If somebody else has done the really, really hard work for you in the past, I mean, use it. Capitalize on it. There's no reason not to. Show how you're similar, show how you're better, show how you're different, but show how you can, you utilize that. It's a really big benefit. There's a lot of companies that want to go de novo, which is incredible, and especially in this new, tech AI space. Great, wonderful to do, but it's very hard. And honestly, sometimes the first one's not the best. So I think like, if you can, the easier route is always a predicate with a 510K. That's just typically easier. That was the route that we were lucky to have taken. That is the route we will continue to probably take. We potentially will be going after a breakthrough designation because we could do something different, but that's a designation in addition to a 510K. It's also a proven methodology. It's a proven way of doing business. But like, go for your, pre-sub meetings. Have the like, they're free. Like, have them. Have those meetings. They're available to you so that you know how to do it correctly. And honestly, like, hire regulatory consultants, or a regulatory team internal. I mean, that's the way to do it. These people are experts. If you're a business person, you're probably not also a regulatory expert. You might know it. But first of all, do you want to fill out all that paperwork? Probably not. And second of all, it's also nice to have somebody else to bounce ideas off of and to have, to almost not have a safety net, but to have the backup for some other eyes looking at it. So it's hard. Regulatory and healthcare is hard. I mean, there's nothing else to say about it. It is, and I think you just have to also speak in English, like in a language. And not tech speak, because the FDA is very good at what they do for certain things, but they're not designers. They're not, developers. That's not their background. They don't claim to be that. We need to put it into English.
That's something that's come up quite a bit with other folks that have been on the program, is this idea of when you're approaching, FDA in this case, right? Approaching it very much from an educational standpoint, right? Like you would be teaching anyone else for that matter. It's just a little bit of a different audience, and focusing on that sort of that educational element is really, really crucial. But you brought up a good point about predicates too, because I'm sure you've seen it too, but you've been around entrepreneurs that are like, if we're going to use this predicate, but I think we need to do this different clinical trial design or something like that in order to like somehow demonstrate, superior performance to FDA when they don't even need it, right? They're not
No,
asking for it. And so
wasting
it's
your
like,
time.
yeah, I think it's really, really important kind of like point of delineation is like there's a regulatory process, right? But unless you think it's necessary to do some novel clinical trial design, right, as an example, don't do it. Just follow the path, right? That's been blazed before you with a predicate device.
Yeah, I would say that yes, you can but as an add-on, there's two things. First and foremost, make sure your clinical trials are equitable. So make sure that they include all different types of people from all different backgrounds, because most of them done before have not been. So, you could be using a predicate, and it could be a 20-year-old predicate, whatever it happens to be. I can guarantee you, probably not tested on women, probably not tested on people of color, probably not tested of people who are not East Coast urban basis. So test it on different people and include those people, everybody, in your clinical trials. It's actually not required by FDA. So do that. So that's the first thing. And second of all, you can run really fancy, completely novel trials, not studies, in parallel or afterwards, so mm-hmm. that you can show the differential to the customers.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's no reason to do it just if you're trying just to get your FDA clearance. Mm-hmm. There's no reason.
Hey everyone, let's take a quick break to talk about Fastwave Medical, the company I co-founded and lead as CEO. Our team is developing next-generation intravascular lithotripsy systems for complex calcific disease. This type of therapy is often referred to as IVL. The market size for IVL is over $9 billion, and there's only one player in the space with a market cap of around $10 billion. So naturally, there's a lot of investor interest in Fastwave. In fact, we opened up an opportunity to invest directly into the company almost a year ago, and we were blown away by the interest from our community. So much so that we ended up closing $8 million from our supporters in less than a month. Typically, opportunities to invest in venture-backed startups like Fastwave are pretty rare, so based on significant and continued demand, we highly encourage you to sign up for our waitlist to avoid missing out on the next opportunity to invest. You can opt in at fastwavemedical.com/invest. And if this is the first time you're hearing about Fastwave, here are some key highlights. As I mentioned before, we are sitting on an IVL market valued at over $9 billion with only one incumbent. Second, we just completed our first in-human study with 8 treated patients, resulting in 100% lesions crossed and a 93% reduction in mean diameter stenosis from baseline. We've raised over $20 million to date from corporate venture and cardiovascular KOLs, and we have 5 granted patents by the USPTO and multiple FTOs. If you're interested in empowering physicians with advanced IVL technology while potentially benefiting from a fast-growing IVL market, head over to fastwavemedical.com/invest and check out the details. Again, that's fastwavemedical.com/invest. All right, let's get back to the rest of the conversation. Unless you feel like there's to your point, moving those along in parallel, like make sure you're clear, right, on the goal. Is this trial, you know, primarily designed for regulatory purposes, or is it designed to sort of win over customers in the end? And oftentimes those are two different things. In some of the research kind of for this particular conversation, Marissa, it was interesting, right? Because you've been a part of several different like well-known accelerators, MassMedic being one of them. But what caught my attention was the fact that you were involved with these accelerators after clearance, right? Because a lot of folks are used to kind of working within incubators, accelerators, that general kind of that umbrella, if you will, pretty early, right? When they're maybe still in development, maybe when they're trying to map out their reg clin process. But you took part in those sort of after the fact, if you will. What's your thought process? And like maybe touch on, you know, how, you know, whether they were beneficial. Would you encourage, you know, other founders and CEOs to maybe take part in some of these groups?
Yeah, I think being part of some of them are really important. And, you know, I think, you know, you don't need to do every single one. Let's be clear. You also have to do the ones that are for your stage. If you're in new product development and you're just trying to figure out your idea and get it to market, you know, like that's very different from commercial. So, you know, the ones that I was part of, MassMedic Ignite, AARP's HTEC Collective, a lot of it had to do with commercialization. Mm-hmm. So it helped me to connect with other people. Maybe, you know, it also made me think a little differently and use the resources that I needed. You don't need to go through the whole very prescriptive process. There were certain things that, you know what, I did not need to be part of. Like, we know we're not hiring a big team. I didn't have to, you know, go to the, you know, HR policy, you know, meetings. But, you know, you can pick and choose with some of these more advanced accelerators and more commercially staged ones. You can do that. You know, product development, I didn't need to listen to those. But strategic partnerships, legal, negotiations, you know, exits. Yeah, absolutely. That's what I wanted to be part of. Mm. It also, you know, especially with MassMedic and obviously AARP, it's really great to have these different networks that are different people. You also, listen, as part of these, you get publicity. And when you're about to go commercial, publicity is, you know, more or less these are free, you know, publicity, mm-hmm. Which is really great. There's other, you know, synergies, and there's other ways of, you know, strategic partnerships and commercialization and you know, people you can connect with as a result of being there, because you can ask for those introductions to learn. And that helps you potentially in the future where you know, a cold LinkedIn message, not going anywhere. Mm. And so I think like those are some of the benefits from, you know, for me at our stage, why I was part of those, wanted to be part of the network, wanted to, you know, be associated with some of these organizations as well. It helped us dramatically, and there are also funding opportunities that come out of a lot of them, not directly, but indirectly. You get to meet a lot of people, you get to do some pitches, there's opportunities when, every company is raising money always.
Yeah, that's a really good point though, around, if you're in this stage where you're trying to evaluate, various accelerators to, or competitions, accelerators, whatever have you, kind of any sort of like organization or initiative kind of under the same sort of bucket. Just think like looking at who else is either won that competition or been involved in that accelerator and what stage they're at is like really important to help you kind of filter down, maybe which ones you should pursue.
Yeah. I mean, there's tons of accelerators and tons of programs. You have to find the right one for where you are.
Yeah.
We were not applicable to go into a very early stage one. I'm not going to use anything and learn from it. While they could be incredibly credible, Y Combinator, Tech, SARS, like any of those, we were way past there. Mm-hmm. It's not value added.
Yep.
We wouldn't have been accepted. So why waste the time applying?
Right. Right. Yeah. Cause that's the other maybe thing too, is like, don't underappreciate, the work involved with, right, is in applying and really more so positioning your company for, to hopefully be accepted, right, into the program, right? Cause that's a lot of work in and of itself. So making sure that you're applying to the right ones is pretty important. Let's shift gears a little bit to talk about fundraising, which, we mentioned, trying to navigate the reg and Glen waters, but fundraising is probably the single hardest thing that most CEOs have to do. I think there was a recent announcement on your site that, or at least in the public domain, that you were recently funded by Tidal River, I believe, was one of your recent capital partners. But you're also an EIR, right? At Goddess Gaia Ventures, I like that name, by the way, and Great Ballot, et cetera. So anyway, net, you've got a fair amount of experience, right? And you've probably been on the other side of the table, right? Hearing others pitch quite a bit as well. So when you think about just fundraising and maybe kind of frame it up for like more early stage fundraising, seed, series A-ish, phases, like what's worked really well for you or like conversely, like where do you see most CEOs kind of fail in this process?
I mean, listen, fundraising is the bane of my existence and I wish I never had to do it again, but unfortunately, it is, as you said, it is most of the time the CEO's job and it's a big part of the job, quite honestly, it is the hardest. I would say think outside your small niche, so for us, we're women's health. Unfortunately, only 2% of venture capital dollars go to women's health. 2%, even though we're 51% of the population. Disgusting, sad. We're all trying to work on it and change that. Hopefully, us just raising our seed round and eventually our Series A will help continue to change that, which would be wonderful. But it's a lot of work to do. But I'm not just going to women's health or femtech investors. I'm going to healthcare investors or tech investors. So think outside your niche, stay in your industry, let's just be clear. But, if you're in, heart disease, yeah, there's a few investors that will invest in that. But that's something that affects everybody. That's just a general healthcare problem. Honestly, fertility, same thing, affects everybody. So yeah, there's specific fertility investors, but you have to look at it on a global scale. So, think about that. That's the first thing I would always say, because first of all, if you only have femtech investors or only have, certain investors in this one niche, you actually don't get the visibility and it will not help you later on when you're trying to exit, because you need the breadth of everyone's experience. So, we have Tidal River, they invest in women, not specifically women's health, but women leaders. Great. I wanted those, but I wanted other people who invest, also in men, so that I could be one of the women that they've actually invested in. So, let me help their DEI metrics. I mean, no problem. I'll take it. I'll take the money. Use what you have to your advantage.
Yeah.
You're a person of color. You know what? It's tons of funding, trying to change that, because 0.5%, 0.5, not even 1%, 5% of funding goes to people of color. It's disgusting.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of people working to change that. Use that to your advantage then. Work to be the one that changes it. So that's what I'm saying. So do your research, go after people who are, who are in the industry, but not in your teeny tiny little niche. And really, like as an investor, I'm an investor myself. Obviously, I do a lot of work and, with investment funds, and I have in the past as well. Like, we're looking for real plans, real traction, and it doesn't have to be everything. You have to be perfect. Like, you have the plans, you have the potential right people, you're working towards it, you're making progress. That's what we want to see. We do not want to see beautiful graphs that you spent all this time and money trying to create, but no actual work behind the surface. I mean, my background is operations. Like, I'm like the worst person to have in any diligence because I will dive into every single detail to make sure that you actually have a plan behind there. I'm the best and the worst. I mean, I'm the worst for the people who are fluffy. I'm the best for the investors who are looking for something good. But, you need to have the plans. Like, and it doesn't have to be immediate. I mean, listen, we're not going to be filing for CE until June. Yeah, it's a long way away. And I've been saying June for a very long time. So it's just not something you could do quickly. So it's like, yeah, okay, we're going to do it. Why are you going to do it in June? Because we had to do this and this and this first. We did all these other things first in order to get ready for it. So it's not realistic for me to say I'm doing it tomorrow. While that's what you might like, it's not realistic. And so I think like having things based in reality is important for regardless of what stage you're in, but especially early on. And if you don't know, have great board members, have great advisors, have great people surrounding you who can help you. To change a board is difficult. And it, typically happens at certain funding milestones, but having advisors, you have 400, I mean, you can have a lot of advisors and in certain categories. We have a scientific advisory board. We have a technical advisory board. We have, strategic advisors. Like, you can have people in different categories helping you with all of these different areas. And so have them around you to help formulate those plans when you're communicating. And just be clear, like, most investors, especially in a sector, they kind of know what they're talking about. So like, oh, we don't need FDA. Yeah, you do. And really, if you don't, please try to explain it very clearly why you don't
Right.
or why you're not going after it eventually. Like, be clear, because not everybody is an expert, and it is assumed if you're in healthcare, you're going after some sort of clearance. And if you're not, you really need to explain that.
Yeah. Or at the very least, it's going to catch someone's attention, right? That does invest in a lot of healthcare. Yeah, for sure. But your point about like just utilizing advisors too, and again, this isn't like rocket science per se, but I mean, you probably have heard this a number of times, where someone will complain about their board. Oh, my board sucks. They're not doing anything for me. Blah blah blah. It's like, well, to your point, like there's a lot of advisors that actually don't want a board seat. They don't want that type of commitment.
And they can't. Actually, sometimes they
Yes.
can't.
Yeah. Yep. And so it's a really good point. Like you can, just because maybe you're not, maybe you feel like you don't have the greatest board, that doesn't prevent you from like bringing along like other really, really smart folks to help fill in the gaps for sure.
Back up your advisors. Yeah, you might have to give them like, some options and equity and, maybe a little bit of capital, but like, have them supplement with maybe the board is not doing. And, again, as I said, you typically make changes to the board at inflection points. At the finalization of a seed round, at the finalization of an A round, at the finalization of certain, at a founding, things like that. But, you like put these advisors around you. And also, they're candidates for the board in the future, and they actually get to try you out. You get to try them out. And, it's a good win-win both sides.
Such a good point, right? Because if you're like, you'll be able to tell a lot, right? Working with someone, even if it's in like a loose, semi-loose kind of advisory level capacity, much better that you kind of know who you're dealing with, right? When that maybe that eventual conversation comes up where you need to expand the board, whatever. So yeah, really, really great point. And kind of circling back to I guess the first part of your answer around kind of going beyond your niche, right? I like, and this isn't like novel per se, but like I always like to use the analogy of like, this funnel-based approach, right, to fundraising, where like the top of your funnel should be pretty wide. That doesn't mean that you're, if you're at seed stage, you're pitching a growth stage equity investor, right?
Right.
No,
No,
of
you
course
have to be
not.
realistic, of course.
Yeah,
Yeah.
yeah, yeah. But I mean, like, especially in today's like fundraising environment, like it's even that much more important to go wide, right? You need to start wide, and it's a lot of work, and a lot of times it's not going to be something you enjoy on a daily basis, but like, it's probably the single biggest thing that you need to do as CEO, right? Is keep money in the bank.
Yeah, no doubt.
right. Before we get
thank
to the
you for my 4 a.m. anxiety. Yes.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it's interesting. You mentioned, I mean, like, I've never met like a CEO that like really, really loves fundraising. You know what I mean? It's just like their passion. I mean, that's not the case, but it's a necessary evil to get
where you want to go. I mean, it is. And I don't think there's anybody who really loves to do it. You have to.
Yeah.
You have to. This is your job.
Yeah, exactly. And I think I was in this conversation with Dan Rose, who was recently on the program. He's the founder of Limflow. They recently had a nice exit. Really, really sharp guy. A lot of experience under his belt. He was mentioning the same thing. It's like, you'll get through certain times in your startup where it's like this, that's all you do. That's like 100% of your time is just fundraising, and it's a grind. But it's like, you have to do it, right? Otherwise the company dies on the vine. So with that said, before we get to the rapid fire portion of this interview, last question around commercial, right? You mentioned earlier your channel strategy, which I think in kind of pure play device, most people think of commercialization, right? As I got to build out the sales team, et cetera, et cetera. And it's like, there may be other ways to go about it. So when you think about, finding, those channel partners, distributors, right? Mm-hmm. Like, are there certain things that have been helpful for you that have kind of, what's your general kind of approach to winning over potential partners?
Well, I mean, find out who's big in the industry and go after some of those. And it's not going to be the big, it might not be first and foremost the biggest OEM. We're software, but we're software that can go onto hardware, but also we're software that can partner with other software. So, you have to think about a few different avenues, and they can't be in full competition with each other because there's exclusivity clauses in most contracts. And so you need to figure out a few different avenues. And that's kind of what we've decided to do, partner with some software, partner with some hardware. Also think about who you might actually want as your exit. Hmm. Partner with them. It's like, try it before you buy it.
Yeah.
Try it. And then, eventually it'd be so uncomfortable because you're doing so well, they're just going to buy it. Or they see the value. It gives them an opportunity to see the value. So those are some of the things that we've gone after. Some of them are strategic. And listen, you don't need to partner with everybody. You can't. That's just a lot. It's too time consuming. But figure out what your exit plan is. There's a lot of companies such as ours that will be going after an exit, in a nearer term than 10 years. Mm-hmm. And figure out who might be or who are players in that industry and in that arena so that you can say, might not be them, but they'll prove to X, Y, and Z that there is commercial value and they'll trust them. And so, go after those players.
Yeah, good stuff. All right, before we get to the rapid fire portion of this interview, the website again is Deep Look Medical, just as it sounds. Deep, DEEP, Look, LOOK, Medical, deeplookmedical.com. We'll link to it again in the full write-up on MedCiter, as well as Marissa's LinkedIn profile, so you can get a better sense for kind of her, what she's done in the past and what she's working on currently. So next 5 minutes or so is just a series of rapid fire questions. Marissa, if you want to expound on your answers, certainly feel free to do so. But the first one on the docket is, when you think about the next 12 months ahead for Deep Look, you're obviously, in the scaling up your commercial efforts. What are you most looking forward to? Is there something that really gets you excited?
Really looking forward to our new products, expansion into other healthcare areas, women having better health, because that's what this is all about, and people having better health. We're starting in women's health. We're going into other people, everyone's health. I'm just excited for expansion so that people have better health. That's it, period.
Simple enough, right? All right, next question is, thinking about, let's maybe focus on when you officially took over the CEO role of Deep Look. Is there one thing in particular that's been most surprising over the past couple of years?
My favorite question, seriously. I'm kind of surprised how unsexy it is. And it's harder than you can possibly ever imagine. It's kind of like, oh, great job, Deep Look. It's kind of like, Hi, hi. What about me? It's very unsexy. Everyone's like, "Ooh, you're the CEO," and I'm like, and the janitor, and the IT administrator,
And you approve
and
expense
the herder of
reports?
cats, everything. So, everyone's like, "It's very sexy," and I'm like, externally, it's very sexy. Internally, not so sexy.
Yeah, that's such a good point. And I'm sure you probably run into a fair amount of people that are like, I just my next goal is to be CEO, be CEO. And it's like, well, I mean, that's not a I like ambition, right? But it's make sure you go into it eyes wide open. It's like, I mean, I'm not sure how you feel, but it's like it's a very lonely position too, right? As well. So even with a larger team, it still can be incredibly
Yeah, I just
lonely.
read a Crunchbase article that just came out recently, and it talks about this a little bit, and it is lonely, it is not sexy, it is very hard, and yes, you get all these wonderful accolades, and I appreciate every single one of them. It's hard. It's hard. There's not a C there's really just not there's not a CEO out there that thinks that this is an easy job.
100%. Yeah, for sure. All right. If you let's say you just got done presenting to a room full of life science entrepreneurs, maybe some med tech, maybe some health tech, et cetera. And you want to leave them with like one single thing that is going to help them best position their venture for success, what would that be?
It's very much what we talked about actually in the beginning. Solve an actual problem. Don't make one up.
So look
Find
for,
a gap. Find a gap. Find a problem. Fix that.
yeah, look for painkillers. All right. Last question. If you had a chance to go back, and whisper something in the younger Marissa's ears, maybe mid-20s-ish, something like that. What would you tell her, anything from a professional standpoint?
Yeah. So two things. Build your networks. And like build them early and keep them active and keep up with people. And then secondarily, it looks so different than what you thought it was going to be. I thought I was going to stay in corporate my entire career and eventually rise the ranks and be a COO. I was never going to be a CEO, COO of a large healthcare company. No idea that this was even a possibility. So it's different than what you think about in your 20s. And it should be. It should be because you should evolve as a human.
Yeah, I had Kate Rumroll on the program. Maybe this was probably like 3 months, 4 months ago now. She's the CEO of Ablative Solutions. She said something very similar. Like she didn't expect maybe her to career kind of unfold like it has, but yeah, so very true. Really good stuff. Marissa, can't thank you enough for coming on the program. DeepLookMedical.com is the website, just as it sounds. DeepLookMedical.com. We'll link to it in the full write-up on MedCyder. If you're new to this program, we typically have a longer form kind of readable version, kind of with the intent to try to capture a lot of the insights and learnings that Marissa shared in this case throughout the course of the interview. So that will accompany this podcast on MedCyder. There we'll link to the website as well as Marissa's LinkedIn profile. Hopefully, maybe we can find that TechCrunch article that you mentioned as well. We'll link to that too. So Marissa, can't thank you enough for coming on the program. Really appreciate you carving out some time.
No, that's great. Thank you so much for having me.
All right, I'll have you all on the line. And for everyone listening, you made it this far. Thanks for your attention, as always. Until the next episode of MedCyder goes live, everyone, take care. Hey, it's Scott again. One quick thing before you go. You see, I love bringing you insightful conversations with the best founders and CEOs of medical device and health technology startups. But here's the thing. I'd be super grateful if you could help me reach even more ambitious doers who share our passion. So if you found value in this podcast, if you found yourself nodding your head while listening, or if you simply enjoy what we're doing with MedCyder, please take a moment to leave us a review. It's super easy. Just open your Apple Podcast app or the podcast app of your choice, search for our show, and scroll down to the ratings and reviews section. Leave your honest thoughts and hit that 5-star rating if you think we're worthy. Your feedback is incredibly important, and it's the best way to ensure we keep bringing you awesome discussions with leading founders and CEOs. So take a moment to be a good friend and leave that review today. As always, thanks for being a part of our journey and for helping MedCyder continue to grow and evolve. Your support is greatly appreciated. All right, enough talk about reviews. Stay tuned for another informative episode coming at you soon.